This is whatever we lose, like a you or a me. A Teen Wolf Stargate Atlantis crossover fic, written by Talia Hale and read by Rena Jenkins. This story is rated PG-13 and contains additional tags for Alternate Universe Everyone's Human, Alternate Universe Fusion, Grief, Mourning, Post-Canon, Queer Jen, Scientist Lydia, Scientist Styles, Sentient Atlantis, Team Fake, Canon Character of Color. With additional warnings for canonical minor off-screen character deaths, frank discussions of funeral, burial, and mourning customs, brief mention of an OC's internment in a concentration camp, implied substance abuse as a result of PTSD or grief leading to perceived child abandonment. Canon consistent, non-graphic violence. Author's notes after the fic. This is the first story in the Life in the Rack Zone series. For whatever we lose, like a you or a me, it's always ourselves we find in the sea. Maggie and Millie and Molly and May by E.E. Cummings. It's an old joke. The expedition members from California are predisposed to love the ocean, taking to Atlantis like ducks, pardon the pun, to water. Styles argues that the majority of Californians live far from the sea. Beacon Hills is two counties from the coast, surrounded on all sides by old-growth forest and bordered by the Rockies to the west. Save rare vacations, he has never been lulled to sleep by the gentle shushing of the waves, never woken to the crashing of the rising tide. He didn't grow up sailing, surfing, or snorkeling. He's no more likely to respond to the call of the deep than someone from Toronto, or Prague, or wherever they find people crazy enough to sign on for a possibly one-way mission to a galaxy full of real-life Dementors. Dr. Zelenka explains the origins once. They're into their third hour of standing in fetid, knee-deep water in the desalinization tanks, and are desperate for a distraction. Styles would give anything to stop thinking about the damp heat curling their hair and sticking their shirts to sweat-slick skin, the itchy weight and awkward slide of their waders, the stench of half-corroded, millennia-old, algae-ridden pipes. It has something to do with McKay and Shepard, and a time-worn, circular quarrel about who Atlantis loves best. Styles had to double-check that he heard Zelenka right. It was during the nebulous period before he fully grasped the peculiarity of life on Atlantis with the ATA gene. That's before he grew used to doors soaring open before him without a conscious thought. Before he realized it was him making the lights brighten cheerfully as he passed through the corridors empty for centuries. Before he sits in a control chair for the first time. It's before he flies over the peculiarly navy sea of an alien world and his ship responds like it was made especially for his hands, his head, his... Anyway, Californians and the city. It's an old Lantean joke. The thing is, Styles sometimes thinks it's true. Styles wasn't old enough to be part of the expedition's first wave. Isn't really old enough to be part of the second. But Atlantis has returned to Pegasus and needs fresh staff. He's got his dual PhDs and his father's blessing, and now he's on a spaceship headed for a galaxy far, far away. A familiar face in the mess assures him that he's not quite the youngest addition to the city. I saw your name on the manifest, but I wasn't entirely sure it was you. Dr. Lydia Martin says, sliding onto the opposite bench at his table. You went to Stanford, MIT, and Berkeley with a lot of Stilinskys? Stiles asks, doing a poor job of hiding his grin around a forkful of reconstituted mashed potatoes. Lydia's grin is blinding, all bright white teeth and scarlet lipstick. She's talked someone into giving her an extra Jell-O cup, which drops onto his tray with a clatter. No, but nobody's seen your article thesis in print, and I was never entirely clear on your first name. How the holy hell do you pronounce that? Carefully. Stiles swaps his fork for his spoon, letting out a pleased hum around a mouthful of gloriously artificial orange goodness. And they're not going to let me publish so much as an abstract until they declassify the program. I.e., not in this lifetime. I heard from Greenberg you were teaching at UCLA next term. You heard wrong. Lydia tucks a strawberry blonde curl behind her ear before precisely slicing into her, probably, meatloaf. Who'd they send for you? General O'Neill. At Lydia's raised brows, he waves a dismissive hand, accidentally sending a spoonful of Jell-O to the floor. He served with my dad in the Gulf, promised to pass on updates, within reason. They didn't want to chance me staying behind for family if they could help it. Wasn't much of a problem for me. Lydia shrugs, using a tine to trace fractal patterns in her potatoes. Colonel Carter barely had the words wormhole drive out of her mouth before I was signing the NDA. I did hate leaving Prada with Jackson. And how is the charming Mr. Whitmore? Slutting it up in Paris about now, I should think. I refused to tell him where I was going. He told me I was an idiot if I thought the military contract would make me happy. Like he ever had to consider one with an MBA. At Stanford, you did spend an awful lot of time talking about how you'd never let the government classify my groundbreaking work into oblivion. There was a lot of talk about the Fields Medal and the oppressive patriarchy, if memory serves. I was 16 and didn't have access to classified research. What did I know? Lydia grins and steals his last piece of broccoli. Well, you definitely didn't know about any top-secret missions with functional wormhole tech. At the lofty age of 21, are we now equipped for life-sucking aliens in another galaxy? I don't think another decade or two would be particularly helpful with that one. Point. They finish their Jell-O in companionable silence, eyes trained on the unfamiliar stars darting past the observation window. There is a disproportionately large Californian contingent on Atlantis. Stiles was half convinced that it was all in his head. That was before a scouting mission to PX-7413 went south, and Beckett sentenced him to bed rest in the infirmary, sans methylphenidate. His diagnosis is ADHD-HI, and his dosages are lower than they used to be. But a week without work has him squirming, feeling half a size too big for his skin. The pleased atonal hum of ancient tech in the medbay doesn't help. So he monologues at Dr. Deaton with his talk of possible drug interactions until he gets the go-ahead for a reorganization of the personnel medical files. Stiles is pretty sure Carson authorized his access so he'd leave Deaton alone, but whatever. He needs practice reading ancient, and it's a good exercise of his rusty computer engineering skills. It's a win all around. Of the 500-odd military and civilian personnel of an international, intergalactic expedition, 50 hail from sunny California. Of those, 37 show moderate to high ATA expression. When he examines the geographical profile of all Atlantean ATA carriers, 89% have lived in or are from coastal communities. He's not saying that the ancients' descendants are drawn inexorably west or to the sea, but yeah, it's totally possible that they are. Styles, Lydia, and the handful of science personnel are beamed directly from the bridge of the Daedalus to one of the main engineering labs. Lydia's the only person who manages not to immediately and visibly geek out. Styles sees the slight widening of her eyes, but files it away for later. Right now, he's too busy staring out the window at an unfamiliar skyline and the silvery glint of water beyond. They're in the lost city of Atlantis. It merits a modicum of excitement. Later, Styles learns they were lucky. Newbie scientists are usually lambasted by Dr. McKay upon arrival. Eventually, they'll be lectured about their general worthlessness and the fact that McKay'll have to save all of their pathetic asses and the entire city, and no doubt several solar systems before they manage to surpass the usefulness of the lowliest grunts on base, because at least they can manage heavy lifting. As it happens, the Daedalus arrives while AR-1 is on a trade mission to P6S-221. Planet of the Hats. Obviously very pressing mission. The new military personnel are beamed to the armory and led through Intro to Atlantis basics by Major Lorne. The scientists get Zelenka. At one of the workstations, a long white table covered in paper and wires and what looks like a miniature Ferris wheel, a diminutive Asian woman in a baggy lab coat is frowning at a bespectacled man using some rather colorful check. The woman is shaking her head, tapping at whatever results she's showing the man on her tablet. "And of course now we get the infants," the man continues in check when he spots them. Styles bites down on his lip to keep from laughing. "They, of course, will deliver them when McKay is off-world and I am all that stands between us and imminent destruction."
"Should we maybe come back later if destruction's actually imminent?"
Styles asks in English, ignoring the feeling of Lydia's eyes burning into the side of his face and the sudden hush of the others. The man looks startled for a moment before adjusting his glasses so they're sitting at a slightly less wild angle.
"It is possible I exaggerate when I think no one is listening,"
he explains with a small smile.
"I'm Dr. Radek Zelenka. My official title is Chief of Engineering, but all you really need to know is I'm second in command of the Science Division. Our illustrious leader, Dr. McKay, is currently off-world. This is incredibly good luck for all of you. You will agree with me later. Of this, I am sure. To my left is Dr. Miko Kusanagi, who is just showing me the results of some tests they've been running on the Nakoda generator's fluctuations in output. Wasn't one of you a mathematician here for work on the wormhole drive, Dr. Martin?"
"Martin," Lydia corrects, stepping forward and straightening to her full 5'3".
Styles is almost used to seeing her out of heels after 18 days on the Daedalus.
"Dr. Lydia Martin, you need power distribution simulations?" Zelenka mutters what sounds a lot like Zeplatpambuch,
and Styles poorly covers a laugh with a fake cough behind his hand.
"Dr. Martin, you will get full tour later. For now, you are with Dr. Kusanagi. Miko, the generator lab on the East Pier should work best, yes?" Miko nods, motions for Lydia to follow her, and flees the lab. Lydia flashes Styles a pleased smirk and follows.
"The rest of you will follow me. We're no more or less likely to expire than any other day. No need to fret. First, we will head to command. Then we will split off by division."
Styles nearly trips over his own feet in his rush to follow, because he knows command is code for Stargate, and he's never seen an activation in person.
"And you, Mr. Chuckles?"
Zelenka slows his pace to match Styles before switching from English back to Czech.
"There weren't any European scientists on the roster, unless you count the British, which I do not. So who taught you the beautiful language?"
"My grandfather," Styles replies in English, because he's out of practice and his accent's always been atrocious. "He was in Mauthausen for his involvement with the UVOD, emigrated after the war, married the daughter of a Navy officer, and then spent 50 years teaching Slovak languages at UCSD.
I think he mostly taught me Czech and Hebrew because my maternal grandmother was teaching me Welsh and Scottish Gaelic.
So you're a linguist?
Oh, no. The languages were accidental acquisitions. I tend to pick them up when I'm not paying attention. Dr. Stolinsky. General O'Neill said I may do some consulting for the linguists, but I was recruited for the engineering division. Masters in aeronautical engineering and computer engineering, PhDs in mechanical engineering and astrophysics. I've been working on my thesis in mathematics as well, but I don't think Berkeley lets you do correspondence PhDs from the Pegasus Galaxy.
You'd be surprised, Dr. Stolinsky.
Radek grins, leading them around a corner into what seems to be a main thoroughfare. There's suddenly a lot of people passing in BDUs and science blues, waving and tossing cheery greetings at Zelenka. It's just styles. I get that I earned it at all, but it makes me feel so old.
Yes, you are clearly decrepit.
Radek deadpans. And you may call me Radek. Pleasure to meet you, Radek.
All right, children,
Radek calls out to the whole group, leading them into command and towards the balcony's edge.
On behalf of the entire expedition, I would like to officially welcome you to the city of Atlantis.
It's a while before any of them manage to pry their hands from the railing overlooking the gate. The winter that Stiles turns 8 is more eventful than he would prefer. First, he finishes his junior high coursework. 2 days later, torrential rain results in a flurry of wrecks that has his father hunched by an overturned car, holding the hand of a dying teenage girl. While Deputy Stolinsky recites the Mishaberek, Stiles sits alone in a small, spare room where his mother's frail lungs finally fail to rise and fall. He sometimes hears the oddly lyrical tones of the heart rate monitor stuttering before flatlining in his dreams. His father packs Claudia's old Jeep full to bursting for the drive to San Diego. The sheriff kisses Stiles on the forehead and leaves him at Papa and Nana Stolinsky's house for a month. The days are filled with baking, his grandparents' quiet affection, far too much football and hockey, and day trips to anything that might distract a hyperactive 8-year-old genius from the end of the world. He likes the zoo just fine. The penguins are hilarious, and the reptile house holds a terror-inducing sort of appeal. But his favorite day is when Papa makes him don layer after layer for a special surprise. Papa carefully adjusts Stiles' wool hat and mittens, secures the Gryffindor scarf that Nana knit for him for Hanukkah securely around a thin, pale skin of his throat. Stiles only flinches when his face is smeared with a thick layer of salty-smelling sunscreen. They climb into the station wagon with its white wall tires and its newly installed booster seat and drive north to Torrey Pines. For 4 hours, they sit on the beach beneath a hideous orange afghan that Claudia finished days before her final hospital admittance. Stiles huddles in Papa's lap, sitting still with surprising ease as they watch the whales. Papa's voice rolls over him in a low, rumbly current, a mixture of the Czech and Polish that Stiles knows, and English for the rest. He talks about the majesty and breath-stealing beauty of the great gray whale, the wonder of one of the largest and oldest mammals on the planet. He tells Stiles that long after the foolish people have come and gone, the whales will still be swimming back and forth. He says that they're a miracle of and out of time, a blessing of evolution and the Creator's hand. Stiles isn't entirely sure when he became a favorite of the so-called soft science division. It's common knowledge that he'll pilot in his off hours, leading the botanists and marine biologists, in particular, to taking a shining to him. Dr. Akshak Patel, a reedy man with an infectious laugh and a lilting estuary accent, conscripts Stiles to whale watch after Nurse Leahy gives them their inoculations for Athosian flu. Isaac chats to distract the more trypanophobic patients. Somewhere amidst his tales of battling the Marines in the mess to assure proper nutrition and earnest discussion of the relative safety of snorkeling off the South Pier, he lets slip that Dr. Stalinsky enjoyed his submersible lessons with Lieutenant Colonel Lorne. Stiles has never been too sure about the Creator or his hand in making the wonders of the universe. The vast amount of senseless violence he's seen, coupled with the existence of races like the Wraith, Ori, and Goa'uld, would indicate a more bloodthirsty deity than he'd like to imagine. But there are days when he's deep beneath the surface of an alien sea, ensconced in an ancient spaceship on a planet 3 million light-years from Earth. He'll think off to deactivate the shining lights of the HUD and watch a Phlagisaurus the size of a school bus swim past the cockpit's window. On those days, beneath the growing familiarity of the ancient tech's humming, Stiles sometimes hears the winter wind whistling off the Pacific and the gravelly warmth of Papa's voice reciting the wayfarer's prayer in his ears. The only member of the expedition who's known Stiles longer than Lydia is Doc McCall. They first meet in preschool, when Claudius Stalinsky is still insistent upon him socializing within his age group. Stiles is just gaining a keen awareness of the differences between himself and his peers. Scott, with a puppy-esque sense of fun and the unwavering loyalty of childhood friendship, is his only playmate for a very long time. In Pegasus, Scott's an SARC, one of the Navy hospital corpsmen who are team-trained to care for recon marines and their special ops counterparts. Deep recon, amphibious entry, and direct action. Scott never meant to become a super medic. He'd enlisted so he could afford veterinary school.
But I don't know, man.
Scott grins crookedly, slinging the tranquilizer gun over his broad shoulder. Stiles has a jarring moment of double vision, of the same warm eyes and crooked jawline accompanied by floppier hair and a higher voice.
How am I supposed to go back to Earth and treat house cats for fleas after all this?
All this, as it happens, is the snoozing body of a massive, vaguely dog-like quadruped that has chased AR-14 across the grasslands of P4X-779.
I'm sure we could acquire something akin to Phalus domesticus in this galaxy, if you so wish,
Dr. Boyd says, face smoothly calm as he carefully scrapes soil samples from beneath the creature's talons. He tucks the samples into his pack with the mineral and rock fragments they came to gather from the Quindam Quarry.
What do you think, Sergeant Reyes? Are giant casts a possibility?
Oh, indubitably, Erica nods sagely. Even a ravenous bug bladder beast from Troll is a possibility at this point.
See, you think you know a person. Oh, Sergeant, my Sergeant, bloodthirsty light of my life.
Stiles opines, adjusting the volume on his earpiece. And then you go and effortlessly incorporate Adams into the conversation, and I have to wonder if you're secretly nerdy as well as intelligent, beautiful, and deadly.
The heart of a woman may hold many secrets, Stalinsky, she says, using her K-bar to take a sample of the beast's fur.
She passes the cutting to Boyd, who stoppers the vial and writes on the label in his precise, spiky script.
Yours is not to know, but to observe and enjoy. I never actually know what they're talking about.
Scott shakes his head, absently petting the snout of the snoozing, almost a dog.
Except when they're talking Batman or Wormhole Extreme. Now those were fine examples of television. Adam West. Now there was a fruit who really knew where his towel was.
Boyd says, adjusting the straps of his pack. He winces at the creak of his stiff knees as he stands.
You're all terrible people, Oh, and a house cat is Felis Silvestris Catus, Scott adds cheerfully, giving their new friend a last pat between its surprisingly leporine ears. It stretches and grumbles half-heartedly. Its padded paws kick idly at the grass, but it doesn't open its eyes.
Let's get back to the gate before Fluffy wakes up.
Fluffy? Like three-headed dog Fluffy or your childhood pet bunny Fluffy? Styles asks, trailing after Scott with only a small flail as he trips over his own bootlaces.
Combination of the two, Scott says, glancing back at Fluffy. Do you think Mr. Woolsey would...
No, the team replies in unison. Styles claps an apologetic hand on Scott's shoulder. On the bright side, nobody got kidnapped, imprisoned, married, eaten, or even mildly nibbled on today.
I was nibbled on, Erica argues, twisting her disheveled blonde hair into its customary bun.
Running full tilt from Fluffy can do a number on anyone's coif. Just a little bit, though. Probably won't even need to see Carson or Deaton. I'm sure Isaac can stitch me up just fine.
If you were injured, you would have had me fix you by now. You just want to flirt with Nurse Leahy.
Scott scowls, digging around in his tack vest until he finds a power bar.
I've got peanut butter.
Styles pulls out his own, checking the label. Apple cinnamon?
Trade?
Yeah, sure. Think they'll have that fried almost chicken in the mess again?
If they do, I hope they've got that Athosian slaw stuff, because that made for a kick-ass sandwich.
You're both disgusting.
Says the woman who, given the choice, would live on MREs.
Yeah, well, McKay gets some things right. The ingredients are listed right on the package. For all you know, fried almost chicken is Fluffy's cousin Fang or something.
You're a sick, sick woman, Reyes.
Shut up, or I'm telling Cadman you've been skipping civilian fitness training, Stalinsky. I find it really unsettling there are two terrifying blonde explosive experts in one city.
Embrace the fear.
The Wraith don't dig graves. As far as Styles has been able to ascertain, they do nothing to dispose of their dead. There are no last rites, no memorials. It's possible that the anthropologists have some theory involving warrior culture, spacefaring peoples, and hibernation cycles. He just thinks it's another indication that the Wraith aren't people at all. The first funeral he attends is the sea burial of his great-grandfather, who retired his commission after more than 40 years of service. Styles is too young to grasp much of what's happening, but there's a man in a pristine, gold-buttoned uniform calling, "All hands, bury the dead!" and a bugler playing taps, and his grandmother's green eyes are shiny with unshed tears in her sun-weathered face. What he remembers most clearly is the sudden, pressing hush when the ship cuts its engines. Waves slap softly and endlessly against the hull. The wind sighs as ash soars over an infinite stretch of sun-drenched Pacific. His mother's remains sat for many years on his grandmother Meriwether's mantle in the Burin. They packed neatly in a wooden urn carved with the cliffs of Moher on the lid. When Styles signs on with the SGC, he has to transfer them to a characterless cardboard box to make his weight allotment. He's not sure why he feels the need to take any tangible piece of her with him. Yet, somehow, the knowing glint of Grandma Brian's brown gaze loosens a knot in his stomach he never knew he'd carried for 13 years. Scott joins him on the East Pier one sunny afternoon, a precious six-pack of longboards clenched in one fist. He sits silently as Stiles scoops up careful handfuls of ash to slide through his fingers into the new Landian Sea. Stiles has spent years being the man who is inexorably left behind. Things change. People move on, pass on, grow out, and up and away. Yet here he is with his first best friend, drinking a beer on a not-quite dock, overlooking the not-really-a-bay, as the two orange sun drifts beyond the horizon. Stiles thinks, in another life, his mother would have loved it here. The end. Author's notes. I have a Teen Wolf AU problem. The Derek-centric continuation of this story is in process for Work in Progress Big Bang, but it'll still be a while before the next installation goes up. If you like the Teen Wolf Stargate thing, you can check out my Navigation Love Songs for 21st Century Cartographers series. Curly Fries and Other Little Obscenities, the sequel, Beneath an Unfamiliar Sky, and the McShep future fic, This Is Not a War Story. Reader's notes, I've podficked all three of those as well. You should totally check them out. I'd like to note for the Peanut Gallery that I have no idea if Shepard is from California or not. I looked all over and recently watched all 5 seasons, and I'm honestly not sure. If someone can point me to a reference one way or the other, leave it in the comments. Although the name Stilinski and its variations are mostly Polish, I've made Stiles' paternal grandfather Jewish Czech. Stiles briefly mentions that he emigrated after his involvement in the Home Resistance and his subsequent internment in the Mauthausen-Gusen concentration camp.